Have you ever found yourself just trapped in this incredibly exhausting pendulum swing?
Oh, yeah, the endless back and forth.
Right, exactly. Like you know the exact one I'm talking about. On one side, you're totally giving in to distraction. You're chasing relief, looking for a little numbness, maybe endlessly scrolling, or just indulging in whatever compulsive habit gives you a quick hit of stimulation.
Just to avoid feeling bored or uncomfortable.
Yes. Exactly, just running away from the discomfort. But then, the pendulum inevitably swings back.
It always does.
It does, and you snap into this really harsh self-punishment mode. Rigid regimes, tons of shame, and that sort of grim white-knuckling discipline where you promise yourself you're going to like fix your entire existence by Monday morning.
Which is just, I mean, it is an exhausting way to live, constantly bouncing between indulgence and punishment.
Yeah.
You end up burning so much energy just managing the swing of the pendulum that you never actually move forward.
All right, you're just stuck. So, how do we actually stop the pendulum? Today, in this deep dive, we are extracting the core insights from the RAFT program.
Such a great framework.
It really is. And specifically, we are focusing on Chapter 56, which outlines Gautama the Buddha's middle way. And we should probably set the ground rules right away, right? Like, we are not talking about a list of religious commandments here.
No, not at all.
We are looking at a highly practical, operating manual for reducing harm and increasing freedom in your daily life.
Yeah, and to understand how this manual works, we really need to look at where it sits in the broader framework.
Right.
So the RAFT program uses the acronym RAFT, which stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feeling, Train.
Recognize, abandon, feeling, train.
Okay, exactly. And we are zooming in today on that final phase, which is train. This chapter explores the actionable ecology of training, basically, the daily mechanics of keeping your head above water without capsizing.
Okay, let's unpack this because what really hooked me in the RAFT program was the secular perspective brought in by the teacher, Stephen
Oh,
Batchelor.
his work on this is fascinating.
It is because he takes these ancient concepts and completely strips away the rigid dogma. He reimagines the whole path as a living skill set.
Yes.
It's not about what you believe, it's about what you actually do in the messy reality of like a Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah, and viewing this as a living skill set rather than a doctrine, it completely changes our relationship to it.
How so?
Well, we often walk around with this secret kind of unconscious fantasy that the rules of cause and effect simply don't apply to us.
Oh, wow.
The text actually calls it unconscious personal exceptionalism.
Unconscious personal exceptionalism. That is a heavy phrase.
It really hits home, right?
Bruh.
We think we can act recklessly, cut corners, or feed our compulsions, and somehow miraculously dodge the fallout.
Like, we're the one exception to the rule.
Exactly. But the middle way dismantles that fantasy. It grounds us in reality, teaching us that consequences are, biological and psychological facts. Avoiding both extremes is the only way to actually sustain your life.
Let's unpack those extremes because it feels like human nature just naturally drifts toward the edges.
It really does.
We already mentioned the one end of the spectrum, which is indulgence,
Yeah.
that craving for an escape hatch when life gets heavy.
Right.
And the other end is the self-punishment.
Yeah.
But when Gautama introduces the middle way, my brain immediately rebels a little bit.
How come?
Well, when I hear the word middle, I picture a beige, compromise-filled life,
Ha, yeah.
It sounds like settling for average. I would just say, hey, don't be too bad, but don't be too good either.
I am so glad you brought that up because that is honestly the most common misconception about this framework.
Okay, so it's not just being lukewarm.
Not at all. The middle way is not a lukewarm compromise. If we look at the philosophical perspective, specifically Aristotle's concept of the golden mean, we see a much sharper definition.
Golden mean.
Yeah. Aristotle didn't view virtue as bland moderation. He viewed it as fit.
Fit. Like how a puzzle piece fits.
Exactly. It's the exact right dynamic response for a specific situation. Courage, for example, isn't a 50-50 compromise between cowardice and recklessness.
Right.
Courage is the precise response that meets the specific conditions of a threat wisely.
Oh, that reframes it completely. It's not beige at all, it's
Yeah,
precision.
exactly. Precision.
So what does that precision look like in a, modern context?
Okay, let's say your boss sends you a highly passive-aggressive email at 9 p.m. on a Friday.
Ugh, the worst.
The extreme of indulgence is firing back a toxic, emotionally reactive reply because it feels really good in the moment.
Right, just letting them have it.
Yeah. And the extreme of self-punishment is swallowing it, hating yourself, ruminating on it all weekend, and losing sleep.
I have definitely been there.
Right. But the middle way response, the precise fit, is reading the email, recognizing the emotional hook, logging off, and addressing the issue clinically and professionally on Monday morning.
Ah.
It is a steadier third option.
I love that. It's about using your energy without letting it take over the steering wheel.
Yeah.
You're using discipline as a structural support rather than a weapon you use against yourself.
Perfectly said.
And calibrating that response is going to look different for everyone, right? Like for someone living in a monastery, that line of calibration looks very different than it does for someone trying to juggle a corporate job, a family, and a smartphone that never stops pinging.
Which is exactly why Stephen Batchelor's concept of how we calibrate this is so vital. He points out that the 8 factors of this path aren't separate boxes you tick off on a to-do list. They are a living system.
The RAFT program uses this amazing analogy for that. It says you have to keep these capacities warm together, like a hen turning a clutch of eggs.
Yes.
You can't just sit on one egg, ignore the rest, and expect a healthy outcome.
It's an ecology.
Mm-hmm.
If you work on one capacity, the others get stronger. If you neglect one, the whole system wobbles.
Wow.
You can't isolate your actions from your thoughts or, you know, your speech from your peace of mind.
So if the middle way is about finding the right fit for the situation, how do we actually build the capacity to respond that way when we are under immense pressure?
That is the big question.
Right. And this logically brings us to the structure of the training itself, which is the 3 strands of the RAFT. And before we get into the mechanics of these strands, I really want to point out a brilliant translation detail from the text.
Oh, about a Pali word.
Yes. They translate the Pali word sama not as right, which implies some rigid moral absolute handed down from the sky, but as skillful.
Yeah, skillful completely shifts the tone.
It really does.
It asks a purely practical question. It's just like, what fits this situation right now and leads away from harm? It removes the heavy judgment and replaces it with strategy.
Okay, let's look at the first strategy. Strand 1 is wisdom, which the text calls the navigator.
Right.
This includes skillful perspective and skillful intention. I kind of imagine this as the part of you reading the map before you even put the boat in the water.
That's a great way to look at it. The navigator is assessing reality as it actually is, not as we wish it to be.
Which is hard to do.
Very hard. Skillful perspective is that acceptance we touched on earlier, the deeply felt understanding that actions have consequences.
The cure for the exceptionalism thing.
Exactly. It's the ultimate cure for that unconscious personal exceptionalism. Once the navigator sees reality clearly, skillful intention kicks in.
Okay.
Intention is the direction of the heart. It's asking yourself, given the reality of cause and effect, what kind of person am I choosing to become?
Wow.
Because without this strand, your raft might be moving very fast, but you have literally no idea if you're heading toward a safe harbor or a waterfall.
Right. So the navigator figures out reality and sets the intention. But, I mean, my intentions are usually great. It's my execution where the raft starts taking on water.
You guys hear?
So how do we actually steer this thing?
Well, that brings us to strand 2, which is ethics. In the raft analogy, this is the compass and crew.
The compass and crew. Got it.
And this covers skillful speech, skillful action, and skillful livelihood. Now, people often get incredibly defensive around the word ethics.
Oh, yeah.
They think of it as a bunch of restrictive rules designed to, like, ruin your fun and keep you in a state of guilt.
I definitely fall into that trap. It always feels like a cosmic report card to me.
But in this voyage, ethics are simply guardrails. They exist for one purely functional reason: to stop you from generating fresh storms of regret, conflict, secrecy, and fear.
Fresh storms.
Right. When your speech is honest, when your actions are clean, and when the way you make a living aligns with your values, the deck of your raft becomes incredibly safe.
Let's go deeper into the mechanics of that, because the text touches on how this actually affects us physically and mentally. The cognitive load of lying or acting unethically is massive, isn't it?
Oh, it is staggering.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you lie, your brain has to dedicate active, continuous cognitive energy to maintaining that lie.
Because you have to keep the story straight.
Exactly. You have to remember who you told, what the specific details were, and monitor your environment for anyone who might expose you.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. It spikes your cortisol. Your nervous system's threat network just runs hot constantly.
Wow.
So when you practice skillful speech or skillful action, you aren't just being a good person. You are literally lowering the cognitive and biological load on your nervous system. You are removing psychological friction.
which means you aren't constantly being rocked by the consequences of your own behavior.
Precisely.
But, you know, you can't control the weather outside the raft. Life is still going to throw chaotic storms at you. Sickness, job loss, grief. So if the crew is doing their job and not causing internal chaos, how does the raft survive the external chaos?
And that is the role of strand three, mental discipline, or the stability and ballast of the vessel.
Oh, ballast, okay.
This includes skillful effort, skillful mindfulness, and skillful collectedness. This is the sheer weight and focus that keeps you from being thrown overboard when the winds pick up outside.
I want to clarify collectedness here, because mindfulness is a term we hear everywhere, right? Like, it's noticing the present moment. But collectedness feels different.
It is different. Collectedness, or samadhi in the original language, is the mind's ability to gather itself into a single unified point without scattering.
Oh, interesting.
If mindfulness is a broad floodlight illuminating the whole room, collectedness is a laser beam.
I like that. Floodlight versus laser beam?
Yeah, it is the deep, stable concentration that allows you to penetrate complex problems without your attention fracturing.
Wait, let me stop you there and play devil's advocate for a second.
Go for it.
There is a journaling prompt in the raft program called the three-legged stool, and it really got me thinking.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, because I know people who are incredible at meditation. They sit on the cushion for an hour every day. They have that laser beam collectedness you're talking about, but they are absolute nightmares to work with.
We all know someone like that.
Right. Like, they are selfish, they gossip, they cut corners. So my question is, can I just build my mental discipline and skip the ethics part? Do I really need to look at my behavior if my meditation practice is strong?
It's so common for people to want the peace of mindfulness without the accountability of ethics.
Yeah.
But if we use the raft analogy, building mental discipline without ethics is like trying to carefully balance and stabilize your raft while your crew is actively drilling holes in the deck.
Wow. Drilling holes in the deck.
Yeah.
You can't bail water fast enough to fix that.
You simply can't. The mind cannot settle into true, lasting collectedness if it is constantly vibrating with the aftershocks of poor ethical choices.
That makes total sense.
If you're keeping secrets, gossiping, or acting out of resentment, your threat system, as we discussed with the cognitive load, is just running hot.
The cortisol is up.
Right. You will sit down to meditate, and your mind will be a storm of anxiety, defensiveness, and justification.
So true.
You might achieve a temporary forced concentration, but the underlying stability collapses because the foundation is compromised by your own actions.
You cannot meditate away the stress of actively causing chaos in your own life.
Exactly.
The friction has to be removed at the source.
Which is why the hen has to keep all the eggs warm. Wisdom, ethics, and mental discipline rely on each other to function. They really do.
Okay, so we have the philosophical structure. We understand the three strands and why we can't skip any of them. But here's where it gets really practical for me. We've all tried to force our way into better habits using pure willpower,
yeah.
Right? And it usually ends with us exhausted, right back in our old compulsive behaviors.
The white knuckle grip.
Yes. So how does this framework actually change our behavior over time without relying on that white knuckle grip?
The RAF program answers this with a brilliant concept called the living loop.
The living loop.
Yeah. The living loop moves us away from the idea that practice is something you possess or a destination you reach. It is a continuous self-feeding engine.
Okay.
And it works through a very specific domino effect that fundamentally changes your psychology.
Trace the dominoes for me. How did the loop actually start?
It starts with perspective. When your perspective clears up even just a little bit, like when you truly see that your compulsive actions are causing you suffering and that consequences are real, your intention naturally softens.
It softens.
Yeah. You realize on a gut level that you don't want to cause pain for yourself or others. And when your intention softens, your speech and your actions naturally become less harmful.
Which is the ethics strand engaging.
Exactly.
And as we established earlier, less harm means fewer aftershocks.
Exactly. You have less conflict to clean up at work. You have fewer regrets keeping you awake at 3 a.m.
The internal noise goes down.
Yes. The inner noise drops dramatically. And because of that quiet, the mind can finally settle.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Right. When the mind settles, mindfulness and that laser beam collectedness can actually show up without you having to force them with sheer willpower.
Wow.
And from that place of calm mental clarity, your understanding of reality, which is your perspective, deepens even further. And the loop feeds itself all over again.
It's a self-sustaining ecosystem that removes friction rather than adding force.
Beautifully put.
And the science backing this up is fascinating. The RAFT program dives into the neuroscience here, pointing out that the brain isn't powered by a single willpower switch that you just need to try harder to flip.
Right. The brain is a complex web of interacting networks. Compulsion, you know, that terrifying feeling of being totally out of control and driven by your cravings, that thrives when those networks fragment.
The text mentions how the threat network physically overrides the rest of the brain.
Yes. Your amygdala, which is the brain's threat detection center, and your habit loops start running incredibly hot.
Okay.
When that happens, your reflective choice, your prefrontal cortex, which handles executive function and long-term planning, is literally taken offline.
Just gone.
The biological pathways are hijacked. You literally aren't thinking. You are just reacting to the demand for relief.
So how does the 8-factor framework fix a hijacked brain?
By training multiple systems together, wisdom, ethics, and mental discipline. When you do that, you create what neuroscientists call functional connectivity.
Functional connectivity.
Yes. You are physically rewiring the brain to maintain communication between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, even under severe stress. You are training the mind to act as a unified, cooperating orchestra, rather than a bunch of fragmented parts at war with each other.
That makes the psychology angle make so much more sense. Because the RAFT program brings in self-determination theory here, which was a huge light bulb moment for me.
Oh, absolutely.
It suggests that we can only sustain long-term change when our actions are aligned with our own deeply held values. They call it autonomous motivation.
Right.
But when we are driven by guilt, fear, or that heavy, terrible word, should, you know, like, I should be a better person, or I must do this to punish myself for yesterday, that's what they call controlled motivation.
And controlled motivation is essentially burning shame as fuel.
Yeah.
Shame burns incredibly fast and hot, but it leaves you completely depleted.
Which then just feeds the exact compulsive behaviors we're trying to escape. We feel depleted and terrible about ourselves, so we seek out indulgence and numbing to escape the feeling of shame, which starts the pendulum swinging all over again.
Exactly. The brilliance of the middle way is how it shifts your entire center of gravity away from shame.
Right.
You aren't practicing these 8 factors because you are a fundamentally flawed person who needs to be punished into being acceptable.
God, that's a relief.
You practice because you actually care about the life you're building.
Mm-hmm.
The results aren't some mystical reward in the afterlife. They are directly livable right now.
Yeah.
You get better relationships, a clearer mind, and just fewer disasters to clean up on Monday morning.
Bringing it down to the daily application, I was looking at the effort tune-up concept from the text.
Oh, yeah, that's crucial.
Because my instinct, and I think a lot of people's instinct, is always the dramatic overhaul.
Of course.
I want to clear my calendar, wake up at 4 a.m., meditate for 2 hours, and just be perfect from now on. But this framework suggests something much more sustainable. Instead of trying to fix my entire life in one weekend, this is about finding the minimum effective dose of effort.
The middle way keeps us off the rocks of those dramatic, unsustainable extremes. It is never about grand, sweeping declarations of moral perfection.
Right.
It is about taking the next good enough step. You take that step, you observe the results without judgment, and you adjust.
Just reading the data.
Yeah. If your effort is too tight and you feel yourself getting rigid and anxious, you loosen up. If your effort is too loose and you find yourself drifting into old, numbing habits, you dial it in. It requires you to constantly read the weather.
It proves that this entire program is about continuous movement. It really is the standing order for the rest of your life.
It is a lifelong voyage. It doesn't demand perfection. Perfection is a static, dead concept.
No, I like that.
This demands honesty, steadiness, and the profound willingness to begin again and again and again.
Yeah.
When you drift off course, and you will because the weather changes, you simply return to the oars. You return to the voyage.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this deep dive right now? It means you can drop the incredibly heavy luggage of thinking you need to be flawless. Gautama's middle way program is about calibrating your own specific life.
Exactly.
It's about looking at your daily friction, lowering the cognitive load of your actions, and building a raft that can handle your unique weather without capsizing.
And we definitely need to mention where all this incredibly practical, life-altering wisdom is coming from.
Yes, absolutely.
The RAFT program we've been unpacking today is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen.
And the most remarkable part of this is that they are making the entire 66-chapter workbook freely available online.
Which is amazing.
It's incredible. You can go explore the whole framework, dive into the journaling prompts like the three-legged stool, and read the science behind functional connectivity. Just visit raft2freedom.org. That's raft, the number two, freedom.org.
Yep.
It is a massive, completely free resource designed to help you build this living skill set.
It's such an incredible tool for anyone who wants to stop the pendulum swing and seriously engage with this practice.
It really is. So as we close out this deep dive, I want to leave you with something to chew on, a specific self-reflection from the text that you can carry with you today. Ask yourself, do I secretly believe life shouldn't be this hard for me? What actually changes when I bring in a wider perspective of how things really are?
Don't worry about achieving. Don't worry about perfection. Just be there each moment as best you can. That's from Pema Chodron.
Let the pendulum stop swinging. Find your middle, build your raft, and just take the next good enough step.